yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we want to follow up with our assessment of the past and what it means going forward. 2020 is a very important year economically and politically, a kind of a juncture. In previous shows, last two shows, we talked about the 10 most important events, economic events in the U.S. last year, 2019. And the 10 most important political events and technological events in the last year in the U.S., 2019. So we've looked at 2019 from the perspective of the U.S., and we looked at 2019 globally as well. Today, what we want to do is take even a further step back and look at the decade we've just left. What are the most important economic and political events in the U.S. and globally in the last decade? And that gives us a good sense of where we're going here, probably, likely, in the decade ahead and the year ahead. Okay, so let's just jump right into that and talk about the 10 most important U.S. economic events in the decade 2010 to 19 that just ended. All right, at the beginning here, you know, most important in the U.S., let's look at the U.S. first, I think has been the failure of the Obama Economic Recovery Program. Failure in a couple sense. Failure in the sense it really did not stimulate the U.S. economy very well. We had the weakest recovery from recession in the last 50 years. As we know, we had this great recession driven by financial as well as real economic contractions that were feeding off of each other in 2008-9. Obama comes into office in January 2009, and the program he provides for re-stimulating the economic situation in the U.S., which was very severe at the time. You know, when he was signed in, took the oath in January 2009, the economy was contracting at a rate that was similar to 1929-30. We were losing a million jobs a month. What did he do in terms of recovery program? Well, it was a recovery of the banks, first and foremost. That, of course, was done by the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve began pumping trillions of dollars into the banks through a program it called quantitative easing. In other words, the Federal Reserve started buying up all the bad debts that the speculators had accumulated that precipitated the crisis, buying them up at 15 cents on the dollar. In other words, these speculators holding bonds, and particularly mortgage bonds, had paid 100% on the dollar at the time they bought these mortgage bonds and subprime mortgage. Remember that? And the government and those bonds had collapsed to 15 cents. In other words, they lost 85% of their value. But the Fed steps in and buys up those bonds to the tune of over $5 trillion. Over the coming years, as well as 2009, starts it in 2009, $5 trillion. And we don't know how much the Fed paid for those because it was a big secret, but I'm sure the Fed paid more than 15 cents on the dollar. So if you were a banker, a speculator, a billionaire who had bought a lot of this subprime and other bonds, paper, you did quite well. You got bailed out directly. This is in stark contrast to what happened to the average homeowner who got foreclosed. 14 million people out of roughly 48, 50 million were foreclosed. In other words, lost their homes. And the Obama program did very little to bail them out. It did a lot through the Federal Reserve, as I said, but also Obama's recovery program, the fiscal side of the recovery program, really wasn't focused on stimulating the economy. Why do I say that? Well, it was worth $787 billion. About $300 billion of it was tax cuts. Tax cuts mostly for corporations, businesses, and investors. At the time, Congress wanted to provide tax cuts for homeowners, for consumers. But Obama refused that, rejected that on the advice of Larry Summers. I think he was Treasury Secretary at the time. Larry Summers said, we can't absorb that much. And Obama agreed to it and actually cut the amount of stimulus, fiscal stimulus, that Congress wanted to spend. And the cuts were for consumers and homeowners. Another $300 billion, roughly, of that $787 billion was designed to give the money to the states. The states, which were financially in trouble, their state bonds had collapsed as well, were supposed to spend that money on programs. The states were at the time were largely controlled by Democratic governors and legislatures, no longer the case today. And they were supposed to spend it, in other words, on hiring and so forth. Well, they didn't. They hoarded it. Most of it got hoarded. And then the remainder was about $100 billion or so for what was called long-term investment. Long-term investment meant in infrastructure. But long-term, not, all shovel-ready, as they say, but long-term beyond that. Some of it was shovel-ready, but most of it was long-term beyond that and has very little effect on the real economy. In the case of both the states and the rich and the businesses hoarding taxes and the states hoarding the money given them and the long-term token investments here, it had very little stimulative effect on the real economy. The banks were bailed out, by the way, by the Fed within a year, by 2010. All the banks were bailed out. But the Fed continued its zero interest rate program and its QE quantitative easing program, which was give free money to the banks and speculators. It continued it for another 6 to 7 years. Why, if the banks were bailed out in 1 year, did the Fed continue the free money? Well, it continued it because the bankers and their lobbyists and the rich folks, investors and speculators and their lobbyists wanted it. Free money, golden goose. Yeah, that continued for another 6 years when it wasn't really necessary. The Fed continued zero rates by pumping trillions of dollars into the economy through QE and other means. What happened was very clearly, you look at the economic record, in other words, there wasn't much of a fiscal stimulus. There was barely any infrastructure spending program here, mostly tax cuts and money to the states that got hoarded in both cases. We got a very, very weak recovery after that. There was a little follow-up stimulus a year after January 2009 when it was clear that this $787 billion wasn't working. That took the form of what was called cash for clunkers, for autos, old autos, and first-time home buyers, trying to stimulate the auto and home purchase industry. But the programs didn't last very long, and they were just token political responses. Some money was thrown in to cover the extra unemployment that existed. In 2010, a real Rubicon for Obama occurred, and that was, this program was not really working very well. hardly getting any recovery. Jobs were still being lost and would be lost for several years more. And in 2010, Obama had the choice, you see, of really doing a stimulus. But once again, he chose not to do the stimulus and to instead provide even more tax cuts for businesses and corporations. That was in 2010. And what did he do in 2010? Well, he gave businesses another $800 billion in tax cuts, $800 billion. And at the same time, he extended the George W. Bush tax cuts of the previous decade, which already provided $3.7 trillion in tax cuts, mostly, again, 80% under George W. Bush, of the tax cuts went to investors and businesses. Well, Obama continued that, extended it 2 years. It was supposed to expire in 2010, but he extended it 2 years, provided another $800 billion in tax cuts. In other words, doubled down on what had already been a failed program. You know, this historically is an interesting contrast to what Franklin D. Roosevelt did in 1934. Franklin Roosevelt comes into office in March. In those days, you didn't get sworn in until March. Immediately bails out the banks, just like Obama, and institutes a pro-business policy of trying to raise prices and hope that that would stimulate investment by the private sector, by business, and therefore jobs. This was called the National Recovery Act. This was the first thing that FDR did. In other words, a very pro-business recovery program, just like Obama in 2009. Well, the economy in 33, 34 got a little bit of a boost. But by the summer of 34, it was just moving sideways. In other words, it wasn't really recovering further. You can't rely on business to voluntarily invest to stimulate a recovery. Individual businesses see no sense in doing that. And what they do is continue to hoard what cash they have in a deep contraction period. This idea that business will not unilaterally, voluntarily stimulate a recovery and giving it subsidies, be those subsidies in low interest rates or tax cuts or whatever, does not stimulate investment. This idea was clearly described in the 1930s by the economist John Maynard Keynes. You know, crises and contractions and depressions occur when business investment collapses. That's the main driver. But stimulating the business investment unilaterally simply will not result in any recovery, and therefore the government really has to step in directly to stimulate the economy. Well, as we saw in the case of Obama, there wasn't much stepping in by the government. The composition of the Obama recovery program was really poor. FDR found himself in the same situation in 33-34. But unlike Obama, what he decided to do was to go and stimulate, boost Main Street. You know, Wall Street had not really done the job, even though they were given a boost here, saving the banks. But mainstream hadn't been part of the main program here in 33-34. So FDR turns and stimulates the rest of the economy, mainstream, with the New Deal, you see. The New Deal was not created until 1935. So in the summer of 34, instead of boosting business further, doubling down, what he does is FDR announces the New Deal coming, and that's what they ran on. That was a midterm election year, by the way, 1934, and the Democrats won even more seats as a result. People got fired up over the New Deal coming and voted for the Democrats, and they deepened their control of Congress. Contrast that to what Obama did. Did not turn to stimulating the households you know, and the consumers and workers' spending power, but instead double down on giving more tax cuts for businesses. And that's why we got this very weak, tepid, historically weakest recovery from recession under Obama, and that continued throughout all of his term. So that was, I believe, at the beginning of this last decade, the most important economic event of the decade, because it was that lack of real recovery, which exceptionally impacted the smaller cities, particularly in the heartland, the red states, as we call it today, which were already hollowed out by free trade programs of Clinton and others, you know, really got whacked harder by the great crash here of 2008 and 2009. The lack of recovery really resulted in people turning towards more drastic solutions. You know, the working class voted for Obama in 2008. And in 2012, he said, give me another chance. And they gave him another chance, not as great as 2008, but enough to win. And he didn't deliver. So Donald Trump comes along. Donald Trump rides on this failure of the Obama administration to really stimulate a robust recovery, takes advantage of that. In other words, Obama and the Democrats created the conditions for the Trump ascendancy here in 2016. It wasn't simply Hillary's terribly run campaign in 2016 where she took those states and the working class for granted, didn't even go to Michigan and other states that were the swing states, and that's why Trump actually squeaked in. Didn't win by much in terms of you know, electoral college votes. Anyway, you know, the big event, I think, at the beginning of the decade was this failed recovery program. Second event and third event, which are related to this, I believe, is Obama's extension of the Bush, George W. Bush tax cuts. When Bush came into office in 2001, he provided big tax cuts for business and minimal tax cuts here for households. But those tax cuts amounted to about $3.7 trillion, 80% of which went to investors and businesses. Obama, as I already said, continued it. How much tax cuts did we get under Obama? Well over $5 trillion. $320 billion in his 2009 recovery program. And as I already said, $800 billion more in 2010 and about $900 billion extending the Bush program for 2 years, 2010 to 2012. And then at the end of 2012, he cuts a deal to extend the Bush tax cuts another decade. So you add it all up. Obama actually cut taxes on business investors even more than George W. Bush. Yeah, somewhere between $5 and $6 trillion. So between Bush and Obama, you know, we get about $10 trillion in tax cuts. Of course, now Donald Trump runs for office in 2016 and promises $5.5 trillion more in tax cuts for the wealthy over the next decade. And that's exactly what he delivers, exactly $5.5 trillion, according to even the New York Times here in an article that I'll be writing on at the end of 2018. It was $5.5 trillion in tax cuts for businesses, investors, and corporations. Okay, so second important event, you know, related to the first recovery program failure, was this massive tax cutting continued under Obama. Really, a continuation of the Bush program here, and it really shows the role of the big bankers and other big businesses in his administration. You know, his program for job recovery was given to this guy, I forgot his name. Anyway, he was head of General Electric, and he was brought into the government and was given control over stimulating employment in the administration of Obama. Right. Third program or third event was austerity, U.S. austerity. And that occurred in 2011. Now, remember we said there was $787 billion in the recovery program in 2009, right, of which 300 and some billion initially were tax cuts, mostly for businesses and investors. Of course, that resulted in trillion-dollar deficits. The deficits were caused by the collapse of the economy to some extent as well, because when you have an economic collapse, what happens is that your tax revenues collapse. You know, people aren't working, businesses are going under and not producing. So the government's tax revenue really falls off. The deficits are 60% of the deficits are due to taxation failure, not spending. You know, people sometimes think that it's all spending, increase in spending. Well, that's a big chunk of it. But the greatest chunk is taxes. Tax revenue fall off. And that is a result of tax cuts, my policy, but also the result of the economy slowing down due to the contraction, economic contraction itself. And these trillion-dollar deficits in 2009-10, and on track for that in 2011, led Obama and the Democrats to cut a deal in August of 2011 with the Republicans, who had now taken over the House. You know, I said compared FDR's program with Obama's, right, and how FDR in 1934 doubled down by Main Street, New Deal recovery program, but Obama did not. He went again, doubled down on behalf of corporations and tax cuts, and that failure resulted in 2010 midterm elections. The Democrats getting wiped out not only in the House of Representatives, but wiped out in the state legislatures and governorships as well. People knew that the Obama program was milquetoast, weak, and it wasn't reflected in their living conditions. And I said, especially so in the heartland, in the red states, inordinately negatively impacted, even more than the coast, you see. There was a little bit of recovery on the coast. But it's the red state America that already had been hollowed out terribly by the free trade programs of Clinton and George W. Bush, now suffered even greater impact economically here as a result of the crash of 2008 and 9. Well, you know, in August 2011, with these massive trillion-dollar-plus deficits due mostly as a result of the tax revenue fall off, but some spending as well increase. In 2011, Obama and the Democrats agree to cut a deal with the Republicans to try to reduce these massive deficits. And it was an austerity program, and austerity meaning here, let's cut social programs. In August of 2011, Obama agreed to cut government spending, federal government spending, by $1.5 trillion. So, in other words, he boosted the economy a couple of years earlier, 2009, but providing $787 billion. But then he takes back twice that amount by August 2011, $1.5 trillion. $1 trillion up front in cuts to education and transportation and so forth. A promise of cutting defense spending in the following year by another $500 billion over the decade. Well, what happens eventually was by the end of 2012, in what was called a second program, Fiscal Cliff, they essentially withdrew the cuts to defense. So they left $1 trillion in the austerity cutbacks in social programs and discretionary fiscal spending. What he gave with one hand here in 2009, which really didn't get to average working folks or families, he takes back with a whacking, actually, those programs that do get to average working families in their pocketbooks. So the 2011 austerity program, another important event, as well as the $5 trillion tax cuts continuation under Obama. You know, when you cut taxes and they don't have an effect, because most of it got hoarded or went into financial markets, and you then cut spending on programs by $1 trillion, you're going to get that very weak historic recovery. And that's exactly what happened. But on the other hand, businesses did, investors did very well, bankers very well, because, as I said earlier, the Federal Reserve, the central bank, had adopted the policy of near zero interest rates. You know, interest rates, banks could borrow from the Fed at one-tenth of 1%. That's free money, you know, one-tenth of 1%, 0.10. If you were a financial institution, you can get that free money. And if you parked that free money at the Fed would pay you 0.25% interest, 0.25. So, you know, it was a way of just subsidizing. Borrow as much as money you want from the Fed at one-tenth of 1% and leave it there, and the Fed would pay you 0.25%. So for doing nothing, you earned 0.15%. Yeah, and then this is what just about all of them did. And those that were really in trouble, the Fed bought out their near-worthless mortgage bonds and securities here at $5 to $6 trillion over the next 6 years. And, of course, essentially what the Federal Reserve and Central Bank did was take the debt of the private investors and bankers off of their balance sheets and put it on its own Fed balance sheet, and that was called the QE, which ran up to over $5 trillion. Okay, and interest rates, of course, stayed chronically low for a long time, 6 years. In 2016, they attempted to raise those rates a little bit, the Fed did, being concerned that, you know, a recession, another recession was inevitable, and it wanted to get its interest rates up. So it had some ammunition. But as we know, the story was just a mere interest rate hike of, you know, 1 to 2%. I'm talking about the central bank's federal funds rate. Started really whacking the financial markets and the real economy. The Fed backed off here in 2018 under pressure from the banks and from Donald Trump, and reversed this very minimal rate hike program. And it's back on track now with providing very low subsidized interest rates, subsidizing bankers and investors, and boosting the stock market. You see, when rates are that low, companies simply borrow the money, use the rates to borrow money, not just banks, but non-banks as well. And with rates so low, they just issue corporate bonds at very low rates, and then take that money and invest it, reinvest it in stocks and other financial institutions. You know, for example, that's exactly what Apple Corporation and others have been doing for years. Even though Apple is sitting on $250 billion of cash, it still issues corporate bonds because the interest rates are so low, and it uses that money to reinvest in financial markets itself, or to give it to its taxpayers, give it to its stockholders, right? In stock buybacks and dividend payouts. That's why we get in this era of very, very low interest rates over the decade. We get the phenomenon of $1 trillion a year in corporations buying back their stock and paying dividends to their stockholders. Over $1 trillion a year for 10 years. Yes. And latest, it's been going up, 1.2, 1.3 trillion. So this massive buyback is fueled by the very low interest rates provided by the Fed. And by the tax cuts, you see. Once the rates got so low, they couldn't lower them any further. They turned under Trump to even more tax cuts, hoarding the cash from the tax cuts. So Fed monetary policy and government tax policy both directly subsidize the investor class now. They're not really tools for trying to stimulate the economy. They're tools of subsidization of the rich and their institutions. And that's evidence of a crisis here in the neoliberal capitalism in the 21st century. And, of course, that subsidization and the boost in stock values and investment values really is the primary cause of the growing income and wealth inequality. This is where the big boost to the income and the wealth of the 1% really comes from. At the same time, we have stagnation or decline in the wage incomes going on. And of course, the result is this massive inequality. It has to do with the financial policies driven by the Fed and tax cuts. That's a primary indicator of the last decade in the U.S. And we get this financial markets record boom cycle leading to the massive income inequality acceleration, right? Stock market's up way over 200%. Right, buybacks, as I said, and dividend payouts over $1 trillion a year. Corporations issuing bonds at virtually costless rates over $1 trillion a year. Accelerating financialization of the economy is what we see in the last decade. That results in massive debt accumulation going on, because if you're borrowing money, you're accumulating debt, and the bailout and the continued bailout, even though the corporations and capitalists were bailed out pretty quickly after 2009-10, that bailout, which becomes a subsidization, continues. So the government debt goes from $10 trillion when Obama comes into office to about $18 trillion when he leaves office, $18-19 trillion. And, of course, we know under Trump, it's now $23 trillion. So it's accelerating even faster. You see, the deficits and the debt result in acceleration under George W. Bush. When Bush comes into office in 2001, the total debt is about $4 trillion. When he leaves office, it's about $10 trillion. When Obama leaves office, it's even more, $6 trillion under George W. Bush, accumulation about $8, maybe $9 trillion under Obama. And now in the first 3 years, we already have $5 trillion under Trump. And we're looking at trillion-dollar deficits and debt accumulation every year for as long as the eye can see here throughout the 2020 decades. So U.S. government debt balloons to $23 trillion. State and local government debt has ballooned as well, about $6 trillion more there. And household debt, composed of installment debt, credit card debt, student debt, mortgage debt, and not included is medical debt, but well over $15 trillion now. So one of the hallmarks of the last decade has not been the expunging or the reduction of this debt, whether it be at household or government, but the continued accumulation still going on after the crash, which had a lot to do with accumulating debt under George W. Bush and then inability to pay the principal and interest on that debt. You see, the problem is not just debt magnitude or levels itself, but it's the inability to make the payments on the debt, the principal and interest, that caused the financial crisis. And that, of course, occurred back then in 2008-09. But the fact that you see this massive run-up, continued run-up of debt, means at some point when there's a recession in the real economy, businesses and households won't be able to pay that debt. And then we'll see bankrupt defaults and bankruptcies once again. And it's non-financial corporations that have accumulated so much of this debt over the past decade here that we're talking about. It's not so much the banks, it's the non-financial corporations, you know, taking on all these junk bond debt and leverage loan debt and so forth that are really exposed when the next downturn occurs and they can't finance the pay the principal and interest, and the banks won't roll over that debt anymore. And then we're facing another crisis like we did in 2008-09. So the continued debt accumulation is another important hallmark event of the last decade. Just as the financial asset market bubbles and booms, stock market, of course, is at ethereal levels, and no one really can understand why it keeps going. Well, it keeps going because there's trillions of dollars out there provided to investors that they keep investing in financial asset markets. Okay. So these are the major events, economic events in the U.S. here. You know, I would add to that the attempt to do something about the crises in healthcare and financial regulation, ACA, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and the Dodd-Frank bill. Both of these were passed in 2010 and were minimal palliatives to the problem in healthcare costs and bank and shadow bank speculation. And of course, both of them have been in the process of dismantling under Trump here. And that's another key event of the past decade here, the rise of some re-regulation on these worst sectors, but then the quick collapse of that regulation since 2016 here. Another event I would put of importance here in the last decade was the advent of digital currencies. We see, of course, Bitcoin. You know, they talk about Bitcoin, digital currencies, based upon this new software that makes it all possible called blockchain. Blockchain that will simplify and lower dramatically the cost of payments and transactions between banks and other institutions. This emerged last decade as well. And it took another step here when Facebook attempted to move into a new product line and capture this development to its benefit by issuing, promising to issue its digital currency, its token called Libra. But that fell on its face, as I predicted, because the central banks, particularly the Fed, are not going to allow digital currencies by somebody else, maybe them, but not by somebody else, aren't going to allow digital currencies to control the supply of money and credit or even influence it. So, the Fed and regulators are stepping in we will see digital currencies, but they will be Federal Reserve, central bank, government digital currencies, and not private sector digital currencies like Bitcoin or Libra. But that is a very important development, a very important development here that has occurred in the last decade as well. So if we were to sum up the important economic events in the U.S. here, once again, Obama's failed recovery program at the beginning of the decade, Obama's $6 trillion in extended tax cuts, Obama's 2011 trillion-dollar austerity program, the Federal Reserve policies of zero interest rates, free money, and buying up the bad debt of investors and speculators called QE, the record financial boom that has occurred while the real economy stumbles along, we have this record boom here in the financial markets, fueled by low interest rates and buybacks and dividend payouts and so forth, accelerating the financialization of the U.S. economy. Reflecting that is this massive U.S. continued debt acceleration over the decade the attempt here to regulate the worst sectors of the economy, which collapses, and digital currencies, which come on the scene in the U.S. In the last decade. Okay. Those are what I would call the top U.S. economic events here of the last decade. What about the U.S. top political events of the last decade? We should make some mention of that. Well, I think also as a important marker early in the decade, 2010, was the passage of Citizens United by the Supreme Court. The Citizens United decision by the U.S. Supreme Court meant that not only are corporations people, persons, with all the rights under the Bill of Rights and Constitution of persons, that had been established before that by the Supreme Court, but it passed a law here called Citizens United, pretty much ending all campaign finance reform, and declaring that not only were corporations persons and had the free speech rights, but money was free speech. Spending money was a corporate definition of free speech. Therefore, under the Bill of Rights, you're guaranteed free speech. Therefore, corporations could spend as much money as they wanted on candidates. You add that to the 35,000 registered lobbyists who are all business oriented pretty much in Washington, D.C., and you know what you get is the control, further control of the U.S. political system by money and wealth. Of course, a big event of the last decade politically is Trump's election, his 2016 election, made possible by the ineptitude of Hillary Clinton and the Democrats in large part, but the groundwork laid by Obama and others that hollowed out, particularly red state middle America, which over the decade dramatically went to the right, aided by moneyed interests like the Koch brothers, who targeted taking over state legislatures, which happened. So the red states, which provide the Republicans electoral college control, you see, take over those red states, and you will add up more small accumulation of electoral college votes that will allow you to dominate the electoral college. Increasingly determine the outcome of presidential elections, not by popular vote, but by this very conservative process here of electing our presidents by electoral college votes. See, it's one of the Achilles heel of American democracy, the electoral college, and will contribute to a major political crisis which is looming on the horizon here. So Trump's election in 2016 was, one of the most important political events of the last decade. And understanding that and what were the origins of that, fundamental origins economically. Obama continued the free trade policies of Clinton and Bush, which sent all kinds of jobs out of the red states to Mexico and abroad. Obama continued that, and that set the basis for the problems that we see in the U.S. economy ever since. Okay, so Citizens United, Trump's election, very important developments politically last decade. We also see the transformation of the Republican Party. The Tea Party and the neocons really take over the Republican Party and drive out the moderates. Any kind of moderate policy that these neocon and right-wing interests now who come into the vacuum created in these red states pretty much control the Republican Party. That's why, 30-35% will vote for Trump no matter what. And, he says he could shoot somebody on the White House lawn and they'll still vote for him. It's probably true. Transformation of the Republican Party into the Trump-publican Party, I would say, is another important event of the last decade. Moderates being driven out, not only in the party, not only in Congress, but in his cabinet as well. It looked like when he first came into office that maybe the big capitalists would be able to keep him under control, but including the generals, but they were pushed out or in disgust left. And what that leaves you with is a Republican Party, a Trump-Publican Party, that is controlled by the neocons, all in the key positions of power within the Trump administration. And the neocons tend to give you a war and crisis, and that's where we're headed. The red state shift that I talked about, another important development of the last decade here, how these red states that were until Obama, pretty much under Democrat, largely majority Democrat control, legislatures, governorships, they turned very quickly into bastions of Republican and right-wing Republican politics. Then we see, as a result here, an anti-democratic drift going on in those red states with increasing examples of voter repression. That's been going on for some time, still continuing. Stealing some states as a result of that, elections, recent elections there in Georgia. Gerrymandering, another anti-democratic trend in the red states, really intensifying over the decade. Combination of voter repression and gerrymandering and control electoral college has given the ultra-right in and out of the Republican Party a solid base for the 2020 election and beyond. So, the red state shift, the red state takeover, and the strategy of the Republicans and the right, very significant political development. And hand in hand with that goes the transformation of the Republican Party and Trump's 2016 election. We talked about Obama's key decision to double down on corporate subsidization in at the end of 2010, unlike FDR. The midterm fiasco, the midterm election of 2010 fiasco of the Democrats, are really set the pace, you might say, for what was going to happen here for the rest of the decade. Right? We see a cultural decline in America over the last decade that also has to qualify as one of the 10 most important political events. What do I mean by that? Well, we have this opioid crisis, for one thing, right? 48,000 Americans die every year from drug overdose, and I believe it's like 35 or 38,000 of those are from prescription drug overdose. And the big impact, biggest impact of that, again, has been in the red states, in places like West Virginia and Ohio and so forth, as, you know, under the conditions of the last decade, people desperately turn to substance abuse. And we see that pharmaceutical companies knew this stuff was a killer and addicting, and they pushed it anyway. You know, companies like Valiant and I forget the name of not Pfizer, but the one that's being sued here state by state, a lot of them, you know, OxyContin and fentanyl and so forth products, just addicted people, and addicted people, desperate people overdosing and so forth at the tune of, you know, 30, 40,000 a year from prescription. And we let these pharmaceutical companies continue to rip us off at the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars with price increases of hundreds and thousands of percent requiring people, if they want to live, to pretty much sign over everything they've got. Good example is hepatitis C. You know, yeah, you can be cured of hepatitis C now, but it's going to cost you $100,000, right? And there's certain biologicals, drugs that will, you know, pretty much save your life from cancer and so forth, but that'll cost you millions of dollars. and we let this happen. The politicians let this happen because, by the way, the pharmaceutical companies, I think, are the biggest spenders on lobbying of all the industries. Pretty close to the bankers and health insurance companies. But anyway, this cultural decline and the opioid crisis, school shootings, right? You hear the big multiple school shootings, but there's school shootings going on almost every day in the U.S. Gun deaths, I think, are about 40,000, 38,000, 40,000 a year in the U.S. And now the rising suicide rate, particularly among young people and others, going on, also an indication of the cultural decline. Opioids, school shootings, gun deaths, suicides intensifying over the last decade. All an indication of desperation of people going on, and very little being done about it by the politicians. The Mueller report, and then the impeachment. Round out these 10 most important political events. The Mueller report, of course, occurs early in 2019. Mueller finally issues his report that identifies multiple obstructions of justice and obstructions of investigation by Trump of Congress, which is an impeachable offense of its own. But Mueller does not recommend impeachment or anything. He just throws the information out there. Some information pointed to, of course, what went on between Trump and the Russians. Inconclusive because what Mueller does is not depose and interview Donald Trump, which he should have done, which was done under Clinton, and or his son, Donald Trump Jr. In other words, they stay away. Mueller stays away from actually deposing and getting information from the source there, Donald Trump, which weakens the case. And, of course, Mueller is only a special prosecutor, which means he's an employee of the Justice Department, who is an employee of Trump. The Justice Department says, Mueller, you can't indict a sitting president, no matter what he's done. So Mueller just throws the information out there. Trump very cleverly outmaneuvers the Democrats here by getting rid of Rosenstein and Jeff Sessions, and replacing him with his hatchet man, Bill Barr. And Bill Barr pretty much makes mincemeat of the Democrats here earlier in the year, politically here, outmaneuvers them. And the Mueller report, a special prosecutor, pretty much gets shelved here, even though it's very clear the obstruction of justice alone was significant. Trump intervening to prevent what you see now with the impeachment, you know, preventing information gathering by Mueller. If Mueller had been an independent prosecutor, independent of the Justice Department, as was the prosecutor during the Richard Nixon period, we might have seen something quite different. Mueller, by the way, is good buddies with Bill Barr. You know, their families mix and associate with each other and so forth. So this was all an inside deal, pretty much controlled, and the Democrats got outmaneuvered. But it's still sitting there. The obstructions of justice, which are very clear in Part 2 of the Mueller report, are still sitting there. And, of course, it's been repeated big time here with the impeachment, leading up to the impeachment of Trump. Trump pretty much preventing any access by the U.S. House of Representatives to the documentations and the witnesses, and then the Democrats having to go forward with what they had able to obtain, which was enough to impeach, abuse of power, and obstruction once again, massive obstruction, and the Democrats believing that, well, we will turn over some more evidence, because certainly if we have a trial in the Senate, that the Senate will allow witnesses and documentations, as in any trial. Well, what's going on right now is that they're not doing that, right? They're stonewalling. And then the Republicans raise this logically absurd argument that, you've got a weak case, House of Representatives, and you have to. We have to try it based upon your weak case. Well, if the case is weak, it's because Trump refused to allow witnesses and testimony and documentation during the House impeachment process, and now the Senate does not want to allow any further access to documentation and testimony. That's the fight going on right now, you see. But it's all part of the pattern here of Trump stonewalling Congress. And what we're seeing here over the last decade, particularly under Trump, here is this undemocratic, anti-democratic drift where we have a president and an executive which is pretty much wanting to go and govern on its own, no more checks and balance, bypassing Congress, won't allow access investigation under the Constitution of its corruption, and pretty much making decisions, violating the Constitution again, to spend money in areas that Congress has not allocated the money for, like his wall. So we have a constitutional crisis that's brewing and will continue to worsen here. The decline of American democracy, whether it's voter suppression and gerrymandering, or Citizens United and money, or Trump's maneuvers and machinations, you know, all of that is an indication of a crisis going on here, which is a reflection, I believe, of the economic problems of neoliberalism, which I've been writing and talking about. By the way, in closing up, I welcome people to listeners to access my blog, jackrasmus.com, where I've just posted a link to my hour-long interview with Guns and Butter radio host Bonnie Faulkner on my book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump, just published. That link is now available on my blog and soon on my website, and there will be a follow-up part 2 to that as well. which talks about the political crisis brewing and deepening here constitutionally in the U.S., as well as the economic conditions that are ripening for another crisis as well. Okay, I think that does it for the show here. That's just about an hour. That wraps up our look backwards for 10 years, economically, politically in the U.S., just as we had in previous sessions of this show, Alternative Visions. Take a look on the website and the podcast where I talk about 2019 economically and politically, but this is looking back another decade. Certainly, we got a very exciting, if you can call it that, year coming ahead in economics and politics in the U.S. Walk the streets a screaming.